Hi, I'm Carl Smith. I'm an economist at the UNC School of Government and a blogger at modelbehavior.com. And here with me is
Amin Wazad. I'm assistant professor of economics at INSEAD Business School, which has campuses in Paris and in Singapore. I teach MBAs and PhDs, and I do research on housing economics. So Carl Smith will introduce the conversation.
Yeah. So what we're going to talk about today, we're going to start out with a little bit of a sort of a perspective on the French economy, what's happening in France, especially around the elections, what's happening relative to tax policy, and then move to the euro crisis in general and whether or not Europe is really suffering from deep structural reforms that, or deep structural problems that, that must be reformed to move forward, or whether or not this is just a financial crisis and once we're through it, we'll be okay. So I'll let Amy sort of start with what the big sort of like issues in France right now, economic and political issues.
Right. I mean, it's the case of France is very interesting because the first thing is that it's an election year, and so we've got, you know, we've got deep problems. We've got high unemployment. We've got a problem of growth, flagrant growth, and I don't think there's a prospect that growth will be coming back in the near future. So if you read the documents that the Statistical Institute is producing, the national accounts for France, you actually see that France is very likely to enter a double dip recession. And so, I mean, the key question is how is the government coping with that, given that, you know, Nicolas Sarkozy was elected in a time where growth was actually stronger than it is now, just right before the crisis. And the way France is coping with the problem of public debt is basically by increasing taxes. If you look at public debt, I mean, it has gone down. Public debt has increased, but public deficit has gone down. It's now 7% of GDP, but it's mainly through increases in taxes. So we've got increases on wealth, increases on in taxation on wealth, increases in the taxation of income, but also increases in taxation of companies, so corporate tax. And so that's kind of the way France is kind of coping with this problem. France already has a very large public sector, and it's like even expanding in size. And I don't think that anybody is actually expecting growth to come back to more than 2.5% or 3% is even unimaginable in real terms. So low growth, increases in taxes, and the right wing government is even putting forward a proposal to create a Tobin tax, a tax on financial transactions. And the reason for that, I mean, it's surprising given that it comes from a right-wing government, but the reason for that is because that was a proposal of the Socialist Party, middle of 2011. And now they're thinking that, you know, they're kind of implementing the policies that the Socialist Party wanted, and they think that, like, they will cover the entire political ground by introducing this policy plus other reforms more on the right, like security, tougher stance on immigration, and So that's kind of the weird situation in France. It's very different from other countries.
So what is the take of French economists in general on this situation? I mean, is there a consensus about the burden of the French government on the French economy?
I think most economists would agree that we have lots of second best problems. What I mean by second best problem is that the problem is not so much how much we spend on public services, but how it is spent. And there's a lot of debate on whether we should liberalize some parts of the economy to increase efficiency, whether we should reform education. Education is mostly a public sector. There's little diversity in education. Health is also mostly a public sector. There's little diversity in kind of the supply of health services. So I think there's not the idea that, you know, we should spend more. That is a change. That is a change. You know, in the 1990s, there was a lot of push for increases in spending per student, for instance. And that has changed. Now it's more about, you know, changing the way teachers are recruited, changing the way schools are managed.
That actually parallels the conversation in the United States. That's really interesting. But go ahead. We're going to say now something's changed.
Yeah, I mean, it parallels the discussion in the U.S. in part because some French economists have been educated in the U.S. And I think they've come to realize that when you do proper analysis of the data and the evidence, you actually end up with conclusions that are quite different from what the unions were pushing for. It's not like purely free market opinion that is actually favored in France, but like a little bit more reforms. If I look at teacher recruitment now, there's like the same number of candidates, roughly the same number of candidates as there are spots open for recruitment. Right, so. I mean, there's a problem in education. It's not attractive. Salaries are low, and so forth. But just going back to the overall issue of the prominence of the public sector, I think there is a consensus not among economists but among the public, the French public, that we should have big powerful companies, whether they're funded by the state, whether the state is a shareholder, the majority shareholder or not. And then we should have a strong public sector. The strong companies are generating rents, and then unions agree with that because then they can split the rent. And that can offer advantages to French workers. And we've seen that, you know, the action of Nicolas Sarkozy has been in this direction. He's been trying to kind of promote French companies in public tenders in Europe, sometimes even being at the border between breaching the European regulations and not breaching them. So I think France is really trying to have these champions, this kind of private public companies supported by the states, either through a shareholder structure or through interventions of the government, plus a strong public sector. Whether that is good for growth or not is an interesting question, and I'm not sure there's a consensus about that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that strikes me as interesting is that, in the American context, we would pretty much agree that that was a bad idea. You know, so essentially, for our viewers, we're talking about allowing at least monopoly, something like monopoly power for firms so that they can charge higher prices and then pay higher wages. And, you know, we would say, well, that's a net loss since consumers are going to have to pay those higher prices. It reduces competition, it reduces efficiency, and so overall the economy is smaller. Yeah. But in the European context, it's not immediately clear to me that the losses are at least as big, because you're facing a more integrated competition from all of Europe, right? So if, just to take an example, if you have France taking this policy and Germany taking this policy, mm-hmm. of both having these champions, then they amongst themselves will produce competition that will drive down prices for consumers. And so the fact that the French government itself is pumping up these large companies doesn't have the net effect of producing like a monopolist for all of Europe. And so it's not clear that it's not immediate. So I have to think about it more, that it's as bad in the European context as it would be in the American context, simply because if you move towards a more integrated Europe, then you don't just have a single large rent-seeking company. You have, you know, 27 rent-seeking companies competing against each other, and therefore all basically simulating a competitive market. But yeah, that's interesting. One thing I want to raise is you're bringing up the French debt, and how much sense is there of there being any possibility of France defaulting or finding itself in a situation that's at least as perilous as Italy or something like that?
I mean, if you look at the yields on Treasury bonds, there has been a kind of uptick in the yields in the last quarter of 2011, but it went down at the end of 2011. If I just saw that Fitch, the ratings agency, said that France would keep its AAA rating in 2012, but S&P said something different. They said that, you know, they would even consider downgrading France by two notches. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty, but it's clear that France is not leading the rescue of Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Italy as much as it was last year. Now, on the prospect of default, it will all depend on the financial markets and their perceptions. There is a lot of, I think overall in Europe, it's like 2 trillion euros that are going to be rolled over this year. For France, I don't have the figure in mind right now. I doubt that we'll default. The uncertainty is on whether there will be a double dip recession again. I think it's very likely. The other uncertainty is how big the double dip will be. I mean, if we're going deeper and deeper with very low growth below 1% for the entire year of 2012, then I guess that financial markets will really think about what's going to be the long-term prospects for growth in France, and what's going to be the impact of social security spending, pension spending, looking forward from now. And I don't think the prospects are good. The prospects are not good because France, to have sustainable debt, would need to have growth at least above 2%. At least above 2%, and that's far from being very likely. I mean, yeah. So
the long run, what do you think the long run challenges for French growth are? I mean, right now we're facing
I think it's a really really interesting question. I think the challenge is precisely how to increase growth. I mean, how to increase growth, and the country is locked. I mean, because workers are feeling that, you know, banks have been helped too much. They feel that they've been hurt unduly because we didn't take as much risk as in the U.S., but we were exposed to the U.S. in any case. So we're locked because I think the reforms that would trigger growth are basically inconsistent with demands for higher wages. If we have higher wages, then we won't be competitive with Germany, and obviously not competitive with the emerging markets in international trade. So, I mean, one of the strengths of Germany is actually the low labor costs.
Right.
I mean, the unions are very strong in France because at each level of administration, it's that there are committees, joint committees, with unions and with unions of the of the CEOs for the management of pension funds, social security. There are collective agreements at the industry level for setting wages. So I think it's going to be a big challenge, and I think it's mostly a political challenge, precisely because the public sector is so strong.
There are all these micro challenges. One of the things that interests me, though, is so over the long run, we should think that French growth is determined by technology and investment.
Yeah.
Right. And so why do we see, and I guess the size of the labor force? Why do we see those things growing so slowly? Right. I mean, it's investment. Do we think long-term investment in France is low? Is it just that the labor force growth is low? Is France having a problem with adopting international technology?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've seen this series of papers by Philippe Aguillon from Harvard. He's a French economist, and he's worked on kind of, you know, what kind of education system, what kind of higher education system, what kind of structure of education triggers growth and innovation. And he was saying, you know, the problem with France is that we're very good at imitating others, but we're not very good at having a kind of, you know, innovative education system. So, you know, higher education has a problem of scale, in part because it's mostly publicly funded. So it was great in the 1960s, 1970s, like we had, like, you know, schools with a lot of public funding because there was a lot of growth, a lot of taxation, and so a lot of money was channeled through to elite schools. And these elite schools have generated a lot of, you know, French economists among economists. But for innovation, it's not good. It's not good because it doesn't generate diversity. It creates like small cohorts of elite people. But, you know, we need increased partnerships with the private sector, more funding of universities through the private sector. And we also need students to contribute to the funding of universities. I mean, in the U.S., I mean, I heard, I was in a plane last time, and I mean, this is well known, but just for the story, that I was next to an American woman when I was coming back from Chicago, from the meetings of the American Economic Association, and she was saying, "Oh, I'm paying $50,000 a year in the U.S. for a college education of my son," and I didn't tell her that in France, actually, you can become a very good education to become a quantitative analyst in financial markets, making 90,000 euros a year gross. By going through a school system where you basically pay nothing or not much, like the fees for the School of Statistics in France that actually trains those people who go on the French markets cost something like 500 euros a year.
Right.
So it's just amazing.
So the skill set of the French workforce is not attuned
right.
to market demands? I mean, that's basically
yeah,
what we're saying.
I think we're very good at, like, you know, recruiting people from outside or imitating things that have been done in the U.S., but we're not very good at kind of creating new marketable products. So we have some great achievements, like Airbus is this kind of joint consortium between Germany and France. That, you know, it's a big chunk of our exports, those planes. And we've created the TGV, which is this high-speed train, which has been successful. We've sold it to a number of countries, including China. The problem with that, we've sold the technology to China instead of, you know, selling the product. But the problem is that we have too few of these. It seems like we've created great things, but too few of them. In the 1980s, we created our own system of communication. It turns out that, you know, the internet was much more effective, and also the U.S. has a much larger market with a much larger number of people to interact with. And so when it comes to kind of, you know, developing products that need scale, like social networks, information technology and so forth, being based in France is not exactly an advantage, because things have to be in French. France is a small market. And I think this is hindering us in the 21st century, the fact that, you know, we're only 60 million of us. I think the problem is also scale. We're too small somehow. And Europe has not achieved the kind of integration that, you know, that's what you have in the U.S. You have, like, you know, you have a very large population sharing roughly the same culture. I'm sure you would dispute that, but, you know, you're mobile. You could move from one metro area to another metro area. And so when you launch a product in California, it's actually a product that can be sold in New York. In Europe, it's not the case. Like, we still have those companies that, you know, are struggling to gain scale. And I think it's key to kind of, you know, trigger the kind of growth and innovation. If you develop a French social network website, you know, it's going to be for French-speaking people, and it's going to be hard to develop it from France.
I'm thinking all about what you're saying, and it really makes sense to me why French businesses would earn less profits, why there would be less rents for France, and so forth. But for underlying growth, I mean, it seems like you ought to be able to achieve a high growth rate simply by stealing or borrowing, however you want to put it, technology from the United States, just continuously. I mean, you'd always be a little bit poorer than the United States, because you're not earning those rents from innovation and from being at the technological frontier. But in essence, you could just trace along behind the United States and produce a rate of growth that was consistent with, you know, paying down public sector debt and stuff. One of the things that's interesting is that people seem pessimistic about Europe's ability to do that. And one answer might be that we just think that Europe just doesn't have enough people working, right? That the labor force participation is going down, and that's going to be the problem. But sometimes I hear people saying that there's something deeper wrong with Europe that doesn't allow that to happen. And it's hard for me to exactly get my mind around what that might be. You know, why isn't it that you couldn't just say, oh, all these, you know, great technological products are in the United States, but then we use them in Europe? I mean, and just to, not to belabor the point, but the United States more or less works that way itself. I mean, much of our stuff our technological things in the United States are invented in California, right? But it bleeds over into the rest of the United States, you know. I mean, there's not a heck of a lot of innovation coming out of certain parts of the United States. But those parts of the United States are still, they're not as wealthy as California, but they're growing, and they grow in large part because the technology just bleeds over, and you know, they can use the same things. And so you would think that would bleed across to the entire industrialized world. But it seems like there's a problem with that happening, And so one of the things I've tried to think about is exactly what that is, because I mean that makes a big difference what we think the long run trajectory of Europe is going to be.
But one thing there is in the United States, but and that is not in France, is a lot of labor mobility across U.S. A lot more mobility across U.S. states than labor mobility across European countries. I mean, the basic story is the following. I mean, if you lose your job in one part of the U.S., you have skills that are transferable in other parts of the U.S. And also, for some cultural reasons, there is a higher rate of mobility, of geographical mobility in the U.S. So that means that if one part of the U.S. is affected by a shock, like it's affected by a downturn, then people can move around and look for another job. The one issue with Europe is that a Greek who loses his job cannot go to Germany to get another job. And so he's bound to find his opportunities within a much smaller area than in the U.S. I mean, I think that's right, right? So your rates of mobility are quite high, geographical mobility. So that in turn implies that we need strong welfare systems in Europe, because we need to insure people against the risk of losing their job or other kinds of risks. So that also implies that we're more resistant to integrating immigrants, because when you have a strong welfare system, you tend to be a bit stiff when it comes to integrating people who you think would not be contributing as much to the welfare system, which in fact is wrong, because immigrants tend to contribute quite a lot to social security and pensions. But I think this explains a lot of the structure of Europe, which is we're not movable. When we're affected by a shock, we just basically stay where we are, and we don't move around to get those better opportunities. And that is one of the challenges, in fact, I think, of having a common currency without having an integrated labor market, because we're bound to see a situation where the northern countries are funding the southern countries, and the southern countries, if they do not become more productive, they will stay in this situation.
So that brings us to an interesting thing. Is there a consensus? I mean, this is the feeling I get, that among the French economists, that further integration is the right way to go, that there shouldn't be any effort to either now or in the foreseeable future back out of the euro.
I mean, it's difficult to imagine how we would get out of the euro. I mean, there's a public perception that the euro has not helped us. I mean, it's very strong negative. There's a very strong negative feeling in the French public against the euro. But there's little evidence that by exiting the euro, we would be in a better position. I mean, we would be able to devalue our currency, which would help our exports, and basically would be back to the strategy of the 1960s in Europe, where France was devaluing its currency to be competitive on the export market. Was doing that repeatedly.
If your concern is that the French wages are too high, I mean, isn't that exactly what you want to be able to do?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so it seems like that would help. I mean, if France's problem is that labor costs are high relative to Germany, and you can't get the unions to back off, a way to get around that is to just devalue the French currency, and that effectively the you know lowers French wages to the point where they are competitive. So it seems like on that scale, you know France would be in a better position with its own currency, you know, vis-a-vis Germany than what it is right now. And if there's no other solution to the union problem, then I mean, it seems if I was a French economist, I would be advocating for a return to a single currency for individual currency.
I agree. In fact, devaluing the currency is like taking a wage cut because that reduces the purchasing power of French workers by increasing the cost of buying imports. So you're right. I mean, and Italy is in the same situation. Italy has been doing the same thing in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and now it can't do that anymore. I mean, another way to solve the problem before the Eurozone existed was to have high inflation, because you know we had nominal wage rigidity, that is, wages could not were not very flexible nominally, but we had a lot of inflation, which was actually giving a little bit more air to breathe for firms.
Yeah, and so it seems to me that everyone's come to the consensus, or there's a large consensus that no, we don't want to do devaluations anymore. This is a bad policy. So we're going to integrate into the euro, commit to have one currency. But if there's no other way to break or to counteract the power of the unions, then it seems like you're really just stuck. Maybe the idea is that we'll be forced to make these reforms, but so far it seems that even in extreme cases like Greece and Italy, the reforms have been very, very slow coming. So it's not clear to me that sort of binding the countries away from devaluation is actually like a winning strategy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just...
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the problem is that the opposite may actually happen because of the crisis. We see a slight rise in the fraction of votes going to the extreme right-wing party. Number of intentions to vote for the extreme right-wing party in 2012. So we may actually see a backlash against democracy, a backlash against the main parties, the Socialist Party and the UMP of Nicolas Sarkozy. So, I mean, if that happens, I mean, if we see that, you know, the crisis, there's a double dip recession, and then there's a rise in anti-capitalist sentiment and anti-democracy movements, then that's going to be really scary. And if we look at the manifesto of the extreme right-wing party, what they're basically saying is that we should get out of the euro and we should end the independence of the central bank. So the central bank should fund, should print money to actually pay the expenditures of the government. I mean, it's actually in the manifesto. It was actually written down by, they have a kind of in-house economist. I don't know where this guy got his education from, but certainly not in a good U.S. school. Or French school, actually, because basic economics course will tell you that printing money basically leads to inflation if it's not done properly, if too much money is printed, and that's actually bad for workers. But it seems like a very seducing solution for many voters, because they don't really realize that printing more money would actually lead to a lot of inflation.
Is that true? I mean, I think that's pretty well known among American voters. I mean, in fact, I mean, as economists, we feel like, or many of us feel like, we have the opposite problem, which is that voters are paranoid about money printing, and so we can't even get a balance that would give us, you know, 2 or 3% inflation. Voters are always pushing us towards zero. because they're so paranoid about it. But in France, it's not that way. They have a sense that it would be better just printing.
I mean, I think we don't have the German experience of hyperinflation. I mean, Germany had hyperinflation in the 1920s, and I think in Germany they are paranoid as well about inflation, and that's why the Bundesbank was so concerned about that. I don't think we've had the same experience about hyperinflation. So I think we feel that, you know, the ECB is far away. It's in Germany, and it's not exactly democratic the way the Eurozone is managed. I'm not saying the extreme right-wing party is now represents the majority opinion in France, because it's about something like 15 to 20% of the intentions to vote in the 2012 elections, but 15 to 20% is really a high fraction of voters.
Yeah.
I mean, the kind of positions that this party is actually endorsing are scary.
So what do you think is the end game for the euro crisis, or for the sovereign debt crisis in Europe? I mean, essentially, are the northern European countries going to backstop the debt of the southern European countries? I mean, are we just slowly moving towards that, or is there something else? Is there some other option?
Yeah. I think there are two ways out. I think either there's an increased integration of fiscal policies, so that, you know, I mean, in effect, that has already started in some sense, because now northern countries such as Germany have a say in the management of Greece and Greece's expenses.
Mm-hmm.
So Greece has had to cut its expenses, and there has been a reform of the way statistics of the national account are produced. So in effect, that has already started. But the question is whether we'll be able to have greater fiscal integration for larger countries like Italy. I mean, is it going to be feasible for the new prime minister to implement reforms and make Italy move forward? I'm not sure about that. So,
yeah, I mean, right now my sense is that it's been pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm just.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doubtful about Italy's ability to go along with this. I mean, if Monti can't produce these reforms, then I'm not sure who can. And at the end of the day, I mean, it seems like the deal Germany is offering, or the deal Germany wants to offer, is do these reforms and we will, you know, essentially backstop the debt, or at least provide some sort of public relief funding for the debt. But if there are no reforms,
yeah.
Is Germany going to do that anyway, or is it going to, or would, do you think that it would actually allow a default of a country as large as Italy?
I mean, a default could actually be a strategic device for Germany to force greater fiscal integration.
They seem to feel that way. I mean, my sense is that it would be a catastrophe for the European economy. That would hurt them far more than the political gain. I don't know what your take on that is.
I probably think that Germany doesn't feel that a default would be too dramatic. I think France is much more concerned about this because of the exposure of French banks to Italian debt and to Greek debt. So we're really exposed to that. So what we're really feeling is that there's a systemic risk in the Eurozone. What we should have, I mean, some economists, I'm not saying I'm endorsing this view, but some economists say, you know, we should have recapitalized the banks, taken shares in, you know, in French banks, and then we should have let these countries default. Some economists have been advocating that. It makes sense. But the problem is that, you know, we've waited too long to do that. So we're kind of, you know, uncertain what's the right way forward. So we're trying to help these countries. We're not fully recapitalizing the banks. One downside of recapitalizing the banks is actually that, you know, we would be, in some sense, diluting the shares of the shareholders of these French banks or these European banks.
And not only that, but I mean, especially given the large holdings of French banks, essentially you're going to have to move a bunch of debt onto the French government's balance sheet anyway, right? To perform this recapitalization. I mean, do we have rough guesses of what the total exposure is of French?
You're taking me by surprise. I don't have the number in mind, but it's pretty large, especially for BNP Paribas, because the shares of this bank were fluctuating quite a lot on the market, on the stock market, in the last quarter, depending on the news on the Eurozone crisis. So it's a lot of exposure. I mean, especially for Italy, actually. So we have we have some financial products like life insurance that have invested in treasury bonds. And at the time when the investment was made, these were seen as safe investments. So I think there's a concern also for like the French households that, you know, they might lose some of their life insurance products. I'm not sure that French people are actually so concerned about that, but that's a possibility.
And the French banking sector is so large that it's, you know, I mean, I haven't seen the exact numbers either, but it seems it's not easy. I mean, it's not obvious to me that the French government, you know, could easily recapitalize the French banking system. I mean, I think the total liabilities of the French banking system are three times GDP. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something close to what I've heard.
And so, I mean, that's, you know, depending on how big the hit is, that's a pretty major mm-hmm. challenge to pile on top of the already existing public debt. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, especially from France's perspective. I mean, I wrote about this for Foreign Policy. It doesn't seem like France could withstand. It's not obvious to me that France could withstand an Italian default. And if France can't recapitalize its banking system and PMB goes down something like that, then that's going to pull down all of Europe. There's no way that wouldn't be a major, major recession for all of Europe. And so to me, I can't see how letting the Italian default go forward is a reasonable option for not just for France, but for Germany as well. And, you know, it surprises me to think that there are people that who seem to think that an Italian default would not be.
No, but I think it's because the situation is moving fast, right? I mean, right now we're talking about double dip recession in France, but it was unclear whether France would experience double dip recession maybe like 3-4 months ago. I'm not sure that, you know, it was. I don't think it was clear that France was going this direction, but now it is. So I think some of these economists probably have changed their point of view.
And how severe do you think the recession is going to be in France?
I was just looking at the some of the documents of different economists making predictions for 2012. I think the first two quarters are going to see negative growth, and then we're going to see positive growth in the third and fourth quarter, but not enough to actually reach the target of 1% GDP growth that is in the French budget that was voted at the end of last year, 2011.
I haven't seen the numbers. That actually seems optimistic to me. My guess is that it would be worse. I mean, is there a sense for how aggressively the ECB is going to bring down rates? Or, I mean, are they going to go all the way to zero, do you think?
That's a good question. I think if you look at the inflation, Inflation is core inflation is actually quite stable. I don't think
Right.
there is a risk of a perceived risk of inflation going up. So it's possible that the central bank will think that there is a little impact of interest rates on inflation. Recently there has been the resignation of a German member of the ECB, and the entry of one Italian one French, Benoît Cœuré, to replace him. So we don't really know what Benoît Cœuré thinks about that. He was my teacher in public economics, my professor, something like 8 years ago. But we don't really know what his views are. But given the fact that he's French and he's worked in the French administration for a while, he may endorse the positions of France, and that would mean a slightly less hawkish position on interest rates and inflation. So maybe we'll go down, given the arguments that are given.
Yeah, I mean, my just baseline guess is that if they're not major cuts in ECB's overnight rate, that France especially is probably going to see a full year of negative growth coming into 2012. I'm obviously haven't looked super close at the French data, but just looking at what the trajectory is like, the fact that it just seems to me that the ECB's monetary policy is way, way too tight for all of Europe, including Germany right now. And
what do you think about quantitative easing? Because, that's one other instrument that can be used and that has been used in the U.S. With these three rounds, right, of quantitative easing. And I think, we haven't done that in Europe as much as in the U.S. And I think France is really pushing to have a much more quantitative easing.
Well, I think that if you do quantitative easing, but you don't change the interest rate, then that can help relieve some of the pressure on the banks. So if the banks have, does that have a internet? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sure.
So if the banks have liquidity problems, then that can help out. Or some of the and that seemed to be the case for a while. If the banks have collateral problems, then that can help out. But if you don't change the path of interest rates, then ultimately you're not going to affect the macro economy just by doing quantitative easing. I think that at least my argument was in the U.S. The way quantitative easing would work would be to lower long-term interest rates, which basically means lowering the expected path of short-term interest rates. But if the ECB is saying no, we're going to we're going to stop at 0.75 or 0.5, then it's not going to work. It's only going to provide some liquidity, which would be helpful, but I don't think it's going to stop a recession. So That would be my answer about quantitative easing.
Yeah, I think in Europe there's a perception. I don't know exactly how quantitative easing was done in the U.S., but I think the way it actually has been done in Europe under the direction of Jean-Claude Trichet is by buying some treasury bonds on the secondary market.
Right.
Some people, yeah.
If your hope is that we can buy treasury bonds on the secondary market to stop defaults,
yeah.
Or that we can then provide cash to the banks that would otherwise, basically unload some of this debt from banks who would otherwise experience losses from declines in bond prices, then that can help the banks and potentially even help the governments from defaulting. But it doesn't actually change the economic incentives for consumers and businesses, right? They're still facing the same interest rates that they were facing before. And so, for the most part. And so the incentive to invest is not any greater than it otherwise would be, and there's no countervailing force against the contraction. And so that's why I think that I don't think that that just quantitative easing without an interest rate policy change is going to have an effect on Europe majorly. It's not going to stop the recession. It could stop a banking collapse or prevent a banking collapse, which seems to be the main thing that the ECB cares about, but it won't stop French industry and German industry from going into decline. And it seems like my baseline is that it would be fairly severe. The second dip will be fairly severe, but I guess we'll see. You know, a big thing. I mean, how the euro goes. I mean, I've actually been surprised at the euro's weakness given the fact that the ECB is slow to lower interest rates. At the end of the day, I mean, if you can get guaranteed euro deposits, and you know, you can get guaranteed euro deposits, but that could help. I mean, a weaker euro could help. So we'll see. But yeah, my basic rough line projections for France would probably be a full year of negative growth.
But I mean, going back to your point on exchange rates, I think. I think the kind of rule that we use as economists of the fact that exchange rates should reflect differences in interest rates is actually not. I don't think it's actually explaining indeed what is going on, because we've seen a rise in the yen precisely because some investors are seeing that as a safe country. So, and people are buying U.S. Treasury bonds because they feel this is actually also a safe asset.
I mean, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, it's the deviation from, you know, interest rate parity has been larger than I would have thought. You know, in these crises, it's gone really, really strong. And to the extent that that's true, I mean, it helps Europe, right? So, I mean, because then they can get some exchange relief without actually having to lower interest rates. But will that be enough? You know, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it to me. We're closing in on an hour, so if you have anything, you know, is there something you want to leave the viewers with about a lesson about France or about the European economy?
No, I wanted just to add one thing about quantitative easing, because. You were saying, I mean, you were absolutely right that, you know, it doesn't change, quantitative easing doesn't change the fundamentals of the economy. And I was just having looking at a chart on, hello, can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Hello, okay. I can hear you now.
So I was looking at the... at a chart that shows the tightness of the supply of credit to firms in Europe. Uh-huh. And there has been a bit of quantitative easing at the end of 2011 by the European Central Bank. And banks actually borrowed a lot from the European Central Bank. Uh-huh. But what you actually see from the chart, I mean, I'm not sure you actually see the on the graph, but is that at the end of 2011, credit was not easier to get, but it was actually harder to get. So, I mean, banks are maybe borrowing from the ECB, but they're not lending to businesses. They're actually investing this money into other kinds of assets.
We're just parking it back at the ECB, right? I mean, a lot of they borrow money from the ECB and then park it at the ECB's deposit facility, and just as a insurance against something going wrong, which is exactly what I would expect them to do. But yeah, so I think that quantitative easing alone can't solve the problem, can't solve Europe's problem. And unless you have something else, maybe we'll leave it there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was good talking.
Yeah, it was very good talking to you as well. I mean, we didn't talk too much about enough about the U.S. I mean, you learned primarily from the European experience, I guess, but.